After the movie Free Willy became a hit, word got out that the star of the film, a killer whale named Keiko, was sick and still living in a tiny pool in a Mexican amusement park. Fans were outraged. Kids demanded his release. I'm Daniel Alarcón. From Serial Productions and the New York Times comes The Good Whale, a story about the wildly ambitious science experiment to return Keiko to the ocean. Listen to new episodes on Thursdays. Want early access to the whole show? Subscribe to The Times at nytimes.com/podcasts to listen on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Hi, it's Michael Barbaro. The Daily is taking a long Labor Day weekend, and we'll be back on Tuesday. So today, we're bringing you an episode of a new series we're working on at The Daily. It's called The New Washington, where Times political reporters interview the key figures in the Capitol, the people who are remaking Washington. Last week, my colleague Carl Hulse spoke to Senator Jeff Flake.
I'm Jonathan Swan. I'm a White House reporter for The New York Times. I have a pretty unsentimental view of what we do. Our job as reporters is to dig out information that powerful people don't want published, to take you into rooms that you would not otherwise have access to understand how some of the big decisions shaping our country are being made. And then, painstakingly, to go back and check with sources, check with public documents, make sure the information is correct. This is not something you can outsource to AI. There's no robot that can go and talk to someone who was in the Situation Room and find out what was really said. In order to get actually original information that's not public, that requires human sources, we actually need journalists to do that. So as you may have gathered from this long riff, I'm asking you to consider subscribing to The New York Times. Independent journalism is important, and without you, we simply can't do it.
From The New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The New Washington. Today, Senator Jeff Flake.
It sounded pretty tense.
It was a bit tense. You started out saying that I've been critical of him, and I have been, frankly.
Do you support Donald Trump for president?
No. I said that I think Republicans do need to distance themselves from Donald Trump.
We've given in to nativism and protectionism.
It doesn't make sense, obviously, to have a 2,500-mile wall.
No, the fact that we look at each other, other Americans, as the enemy. And it's really troublesome.
The party has lost its way.
Hello.
Senator. Hey, it's Carl.
Yeah. Hey, Carl.
How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Good. We're checking out some of the technical aspects of this elaborate hookup here.
Carl Hulse, who did you talk to this week?
Jeff Flake, the junior Republican senator from Arizona. Really one of the most interesting guys in Washington right now. So, Senator, I want you to know I read the book, though I bought it on my Kindle, so I didn't pay full price for the hardcover. I hope you will forgive me.
That's what I would expect of you, Carl.
This is the senator that Trump has been going after.
Yes, they've had an extremely contentious relationship.
He tweeted this morning, "Great to see that Dr. Kelly Ward is running against Flake, Jeff Flake, who is weak on borders, crime, and a non-factor in the Senate. He is toxic."
"Phoenix crowd last night was amazing and a packed house," Trump tweeted. "I love the great state of Arizona. Not a fan of Jeff Flake, weak on crime and border."
He's one of the senators that Trump's been going after, right? but he's had a longer tempestuous relationship with the president than the others.
Right. Seems to have the biggest target on his back. So what is Jeff Flake's story? Who's this Republican that seems to be the number one target now of the president's ire?
You know, very interesting story. He grew up on a ranch.
I was, you know, raised on a farm and a ranch that, you know, life is what you make of it. It's pretty a Spartan existence. And I did shape my character growing up and my feelings about, you know, individual responsibility and limited government.
And self-sufficiency. You know, it sounded like pretty tough work, I have to say, on the ranch.
Oh, it was. I had 10 brothers and sisters. There were, I think, 39 of us raised on the ranch between my family and cousins. There were four brothers, the F-bar, Dean, Jed, Jake, and Steve. My father was Dean. And I tell people often that I was raised by my forefathers. And by that, I I mean, my father and three uncles.
But his family was also involved in local politics and served, and he has relatives in the state legislature. There's obviously some big political DNA in the family.
Well, raised in Arizona, you can't be raised in Arizona without being a fan of Goldwater, particularly rural Arizona, kind of the independent, rugged individualist that he was.
Barry Goldwater, for those of the millennial listeners.
Barry Goldwater was the famous Republican conservative from Arizona and was sort of this gruff voice of tough conservatism back in the 60s and 70s.
This Republican Party is a party for free men, not for blind followers and not for conformists.
But an icon in Arizona.
That appeals to Arizonans, particularly those of us who have been here our whole lives, in my case, five generations back.
He is part of a pioneer Arizona Mormon family, I think fifth generation.
Yeah, this was, the Old West in the 1880s. My great-grandfather, James Madison Flake, and his brother Charles Love Flake were deputized to go arrest an outlaw. And they did, and they disarmed him, or so they thought. He pulled a pistol out of his boot and shot my great-uncle in the chest, and that same bullet went through the ear of my great-grandfather. Killed my great-uncle, and my great-grandfather had hearing loss in that ear for the rest of his life.
This is like Ponderosa stuff.
Yeah, and, a lot of family history there with the Flakes. The town is even named where he's from, Snowflake, a combination of two of the settlers. One, the Flake, and that name is for his family.
The town he's from is named after him, or his family. That's amazing.
His ancestors were sent there by Brigham Young directly.
Oh, wow. One of the kind of founding families of Mormonism.
I mean, a community like Snowflake, there's about 5,000 people there now. But it wasn't just, on your own. There was the town and the church. It's a Mormon community. My father was the mayor of Snowflake. Whatever, adults there were, they always served on several boards and in a lot of capacities. And it was very much a community. And that formed my thinking.
So Flake describes to you a kind of folksy conservatism that's rooted in his family. What would you say are the tenets of that conservatism, and how would you describe it?
Very fiscally conservative, talks about it in his book, The Conscience of a Conservative. And this is, what one of the things that makes him so interesting right now is this book that he has written. But I think the most important part, and the part that's caused him the conflict with Trump, is he sees conservatism as a very decent kind of politics, that you need to be, kind, for lack of a better word, and reasonable and compromising with people and open to their views. And, he has taken on Trump over Trump's demeanor, and he really has trouble with that. So his is fiscal conservatism, personal independence, limited government, but to do it in kind of a nice guy kind of way.
Let's talk about this book.
Okay. Let's talk about the book. Very, very tough on the president and your own party. So I've got to ask this. What possessed you to write this searing indictment in a year when you're about to be up for a difficult reelection?
Well, a lot of the book is a compilation of things that I'd written, a decade ago when I was in the House of Representatives. This book is not just an indictment of the contemporary politics, but we took a while to get here as Republicans. And
when Flake says we took a while to get here as a party, what does he mean? Where is here?
They lost their way on fiscal matters. They became big spenders. They ran up the deficit. They were distributing earmarks because they just decided they were going to do what they needed to do to keep their majority and stay in power. And being in politics strictly for the idea of being in politics.
Mm-hmm. And it is tough on the president in terms of some of the policies that he has adopted and also, you know, his demeanor or manners. And I think being a conservative is not just adherence to conservative principles like limited government or economic freedom or free trade, but it also means that we ought to be, you know, decent and not just try to drill down on the base, but try to expand our reach by persuading people. And I think that that's missing today.
What does the book actually say about Trump? What are the particular criticisms?
That it's sort of his naked appeal to the base. Mm-hmm. That's all he's interested in, is riling up the base for short-term gain, you know, through this bombast and tough language. And this leads me to a little excerpt from your book. Quote, "We have given in to the politics of anger, the belief that riling up the base can make up for failed attempts to broaden the electorate. These are the spasms of a dying party." That's pretty rough. What brought you to that conclusion?
Well, I think when we went through kind of an autopsy, you know, after the 2012 election, and that was the conclusion, that we were, particularly with regard to minorities and outreach, that we as a party needed to reach out. Now, some will say, well, hey, Republicans control, you know, governor's mansions all over the country, you know, state legislatures are going Republican. I think that is true, but I know that we can lose it pretty fast, and I've seen that. I've been in the majority 2001 to 2006 in the House, and then in the majority, you know, now, and I think we share the same risk of losing that. So I know that populism is called populism for a reason. It is popular. Mm-hmm. You can win elections by playing to populist sentiment, but you can't govern that way, and you won't have the majority for long. And most importantly, you won't accomplish conservative ends. If you continually just play to the base, then you may be in power, but what are you accomplishing? Because to accomplish big things, you have to have a bigger governing majority. You have to work across the aisle to have something that endures. And I just don't see that now. And so I'm very concerned about where we are as a party.
I'm struck by how much what Flake is saying about the president and his own party, the Republican Party, sounds like a Democratic critique of the Republican Party over the last decade or so.
The problem is that they've been riding this tiger for a long time. They've been feeding their base all kinds of crazy for years, primarily for political expedience. All that bile, all the exaggeration, all the stuff that was not grounded in fact, just kind of bubbled up. Started surfacing. They know better, a lot of these folks who ran, and they didn't say anything. And so
is Flake getting heat from inside his own party for essentially mounting a Democratic sounding attack against his own party?
I think that he's not really getting attacked from his own party, even though what Barack Obama said, there is a lot of what Jeff Flake believes. You know, he stuck up for Obama on the birther issue to his detriment in Arizona in his last election. You know, he was attacked by the Tea Party. He thinks that Republicans have engaged too much in conspiracy theory mongering. So, you know, there's a part of his party now that is very unhappy with him and intends to basically ride him out of the Senate on a rail. Now, he thinks that he can survive this election, and it's going to be one of the most fascinating elections in the country.
I believe I'm just as conservative now as I was when I came into Congress.
Really, Senator Flake? Then why were you featured in a Hillary Clinton campaign ad attacking Donald Trump? And why did you say he should drop out of the race? Why did you say Donald Trump would never win Arizona and refuse to vote for him? Why aren't you trying to work with President Trump on reforms that help Arizona? to create more U.S. jobs, to build the wall and repeal Obamacare. Senator Flake, why are you still attacking the president? Just to sell copies of your new book? You're not a conservative, Senator Flake, and you're not getting anything done. Arizona deserves far better.
I'm Dr. Kelly Ward, and I approve this message.
No, I won't vote. One vote away, I will not mention any names. Very presidential, isn't it? Very presidential. And nobody wants me to talk about your other senator, who's weak on borders, weak on crime. So I won't talk about him. Nobody wants me to talk about him. Nobody knows who the hell he is. And now, see, I haven't mentioned any names. So now, everybody's happy.
Carl, how does, well, first of all, why did Trump not say Jeff Flake's name in this complicated?
I mean, I'm only guessing, but I think he was probably told not to.
By his aides.
But then couldn't restrain himself.
Couldn't help it.
So let me ask you your reaction to the president's speech at the rally in Phoenix. He went after you obliquely, but pretty clearly. What's that like, having the president of your party in front of your constituents telling them that you're not the guy for him?
Well, I kind of feel like that a character from Harry Potter, Voldemort, who's the one who shall not be named, I guess. but no, it's never something you want for the president of your own party to go after you. But it is what it is. And you ask why I wrote this book now. When I'm up for re-election, it wasn't an easy decision to make.
Well, you even said that you regretted writing it in at the beginning of your book.
Yeah, well, certainly it's easier not to. And you know, the easiest path to re-election in a state like Arizona, or most states where Republicans are in the majority, the easiest path is to just go along and don't ruffle any feathers and to follow the herd, if you will. But I can tell you, I just I don't think that I can do that. And I didn't tell my staff, campaign or my official staff, because frankly, I didn't want to be talked out of it. And they are good professionals, and they would have tried to talk me out of it, I think. And they should, because this is not the smartest political thing. But I think it's important for the party.
So my colleague Jonathan Martin has made the point that Arizona is a state where the president's politics might be more popular than yours. How do you deal with that as the president threatens to target you in this election? There was even this photo of him meeting with potential challengers to you in the primary. How are you going to contend with all this?
Well, I think that Arizona voters expect me to agree with the president when I think he's right, and challenge him when I think he's wrong. I don't think Arizona voters want a rubber stamp president. If they did, they wouldn't have elected Barry Goldwater. They certainly wouldn't have elected John McCain numerous times. So Arizona voters tend to elect independent-minded senators. And I think even if people agree with the positions that the president has taken, all of them, they would, I think, expect a senator from Arizona to exercise his own franchise and to not be a rubber stamp for whatever the president believes. And I would venture that that most Arizonans, even if they certainly voted for the president and majority did, don't agree with everything that the president is doing, and certainly the tone and tenor of his politics. And that's what I've been probably most critical of.
This all makes me think, Carl, about the interviews that you have done over the past few weeks with Senate Republicans who are in some ways at odds with President Trump. Lavar Alexander, who's leading a bipartisan effort to fix the Affordable Care Act. Senator Richard Burr, who is running the investigation into Trump's campaign ties to Russia. Both of those men are arguably in politically risky positions because of the dual roles that they're serving as Senate Republicans and people doing something the president doesn't like. But it's part of their jobs, right? And what Flake is doing is speaking out despite being from a state where Trump is really popular and he doesn't have a alternative role that requires him to do this critiquing and kind of critical thinking about the president. It just seems like a genuine moral imperative for him. And we just generally don't see a lot of that.
Yeah, I think it's true. I've known Jeff Flake, I guess, so he's been in the House since 2000 or so. I've seen him in action for year after year, and this is just who he is. He's going to do what he thinks is right, even if it blows up on him. So far, it's kind of worked out pretty well for him, right? He won his crusade in the House. He moved on to the Senate. He's respected by his colleagues there. He's gotten on good committees. You know, I asked him once if this was at an entirely different thing. Event, I said, well, why don't you just run for president as an independent? And he said, Flake can only get so far. Right. I don't think he had that idea. I think, you know, right now, in some ways, it's about survival for Jeff Flake. So the president made it clear at that rally Monday night that he's willing to shut down the government if you don't get the money for the border wall.
Build that wall. Now, the obstructionist Democrats would like us not to do it, but believe me, if we have to close down our government, we're building that wall.
I'm not sure that's a position that you could support. How do you approach that?
We shouldn't shut down the government. That never turns out well for Republicans and conservatives. You don't save money. All you do is imperil the party. And then also, I'm just having a hard time understanding, I think all of us are, what it means to fund the border wall. During the campaign, for one, we were told that Mexico would pay for it. If that's not the case, then what are we being asked to do? One thing that I appreciated the president coming to Arizona, I'm glad he came. He went down to the border near Yuma. And he even made mention of that and saying that in that area, they're taking up some of the what could approximate a wall, and they're instead replacing it with fencing. And I wanted to cheer and say, hey, that's what we've been doing for more than a decade. And I can't see any place on the border where a brick and mortar type of wall like the president talked about during the campaign would be appropriate. Fencing, sure. And in SB 744, the bipartisan immigration bill, we provided for 700 miles of fencing or barriers or infrastructure on the border and doubled the border patrol.
One more kind of local issue before we move on.
By the way, I'm just curious. Do the people in this room like Sheriff Joe?
There's been some talk about pardoning the former sheriff there. What's your feeling on that?
I say let the process take its course. It's on appeal right now. And I think to step in now would not be a good thing.
He should have had a jury, but you know what? I'll make a prediction. I think he's going to be just fine, okay?
So, Carl, of course, on Friday night after you spoke to Jeff Flake, the president did pardon Sheriff Joe Arpaio.
Correct.
President Trump has pardoned Joe Arpaio. The former sheriff of Maricopa County, Arizona, was convicted of criminal contempt for what was described as racial profiling. He received nationwide attention for his crackdown on illegal immigration. The White House released a statement.
So, Carl, as best I can tell, Flake is trying to champion a kind of bipartisanship in this moment that doesn't at all feel bipartisan. And he seems focused on bringing down the political temperature in Washington despite the president trying to ratchet it up all the time. It's interesting that he was present at what is now regarded as an exceptionally ugly moment of violent partisanship, which was this shooting in Alexandria, Virginia at the congressional baseball practice a few weeks ago.
Yeah, he was obviously shaken by that experience. He was on the field when the shots began to ring out. So, changing gears here, You were at the congressional baseball practice where the shooting occurred. How has that affected you? And is that something that's still on your mind?
Yeah, I don't know how you can forget something like that. I don't know that I ever will. And I've mentioned before, when the shooting started, when he just opened fire with a volley of shots, I turned and looked toward the dugout, basically the only place for any shelter, and saw bullets, you know, glancing off the gravel. And I just, the thought that came to my head that I couldn't get rid of was just, why? why really us? It was just very incongruent to think that somebody could look out at a bunch of middle-aged men playing baseball and see the enemy. And it was just it was an awful thing. And then later that night at the hospital, I was just reminded of 6 years before being in Tucson in the hospital, waiting to see if Gabby Giffords would pull through. And, you know, and we were doing the same thing 6 years later with another one of my colleagues. And that just, you know, it's an awful thing. It really is.
So, you know, one outcome that people were hoping for, I think, after the shooting, actually both of those shootings, was that everyone would tone down the rhetoric. But are you seeing any progress there?
I think with regard to Gabby Giffords, I think it did last for a while. Mm-hmm. You know, it stayed... State of the Union addresses, Republicans and Democrats sitting together more. I do think it lasted a while, not long enough. I just think that today, the 24-hour news cycle, kind of the incentives are there for those who maybe perhaps are the loudest. And I just think that our politics somehow has to, you know, the incentives have to be different to reward those who want to accomplish something rather than try to avoid blame. And I don't know how long that process will take, but it has to happen.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us, Senator, about this. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Carl, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
The New Washington is produced by Michael Simon Johnson and Michaela Bouchard. Brad Fisher is our engineer. Lisa Tobin is our executive producer. Samantha Hennig is our editorial director. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Lansford of Wonderman. That's it for The New Washington. See you back here next week. Thanks for listening to The New Washington. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you Tuesday.